Yeah. There's so much that goes into each of our lives each week. It's just always so humbling to hear each of our joys and sorrows. So, when he was in his 20s, my husband spent a year teaching conversational English to college students in Taiwan. He lived in Taiwan for that year. And these students had about 5 or 6 years of English, the written form, but they were scared to death to speak. Because learning a language is hard, and it's particularly hard, I think, to pick up on the nuances, the figures of speech. It's not a skill I have to pick a second language, to speak a second language. But we were reminded of this just this past week. We're actually happened to be heading to up to a memorial service for an extended family member who had died, and we were on the Baltimore Beltway. We're sort of near the Beltway. The roads to us are not quite that familiar, and there was an entrance ramp, and it had a big sign and sort of some lines on it. And my husband says, "Oh, looks like we need to take an alternate route." I said, "No, that says alternate, and it's really important right now if you watch that car, because he thinks you're going to do that. Alternate. Alternate. Even with a picture, don't look that different." At which point my husband said, "Well, that would be tough to teach a second language learner." My husband, as you know, is well past his 20s. So, as native speakers, or as folks who have learned the English language, we are always learning. And language comes in layers. Words have multiple meanings, and humans, and we are already prone to misunderstanding each other, missing cues, missing the subtleties of communication. We have conflicts that get stirred when we hear one way a word is used versus another. And words are even more than just that actual word. They convey entire concepts. And making it even harder, concepts, words, change over time. Not even millennia, they change over decades. So today we're going to take pride. Think about the word, think about the concept. Because my own family didn't talk about sin very much. And the seven deadly sins were not anything that I had in my own early church learning. Yet somewhere in daily conversation, just reading novels, watching TV, I did do a lot of that, I somehow knew there were how many deadly sins?
Seven.
Seven? Can anyone name them all? Let's make this a little participative this morning.
Greed,
avarice.
Okay, shout them out a little bit here.
Sloth.
Sloth.
Greed.
Greed.
Gluttony.
Gluttony.
Pride.
Pride.
Lust.
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 Wrath and envy.
What?
Wrath
and
and envy.
envy.
Somewhere, probably year 600, 700, at some point, these got declared the cardinal sins. They're not as bad as the real moral ones, but they were considered serious ethical breaches. If one were to engage in lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, or pride, it was a weak spot that would slide you down to more sins. So these are sort of fundamental concepts. And I think if you think of pride as this type of sin, it's about being self-focused, self-aggrandizing. One definition I found of pride in this form is being too self-satisfied. It's about that bragging and not being modest enough, tooting one's own horn. I think it also comes in relative terms. It comes when we compare ourselves to another and just seems maybe we're a little cocky. At a recent Protestant church service I attended last week, there was a prayer of confession early in the service, that was denouncing pride. It was that important. And I think it's a reminder of our humility, a reminder to be humble. I think pride, when we're prideful, we can get in the way of honest communications. We talked a few weeks ago about apology. I think it can be a place where we stand so sure of ourselves, so self-righteous, that we miss what the other might be feeling. We also tell our kids to take pride in what you do. So there's a real flipping there. This pride that's so hard, that's so risky, and yet we claim it as something good. You've worked hard. Understand the value of your hard work. We're proud of you. And then I think pride can mean take pride in who you are, not just what you've achieved and what you've done, but knowing that you are worthy of your own self-love. You are valued as you are. So we shift from pride as sin to pride as something tied to self-confidence. It's a sense of respect. Take pride. Don't be embarrassed. Don't hold back as to who you are. It could be seen as boasting, and it also can be seen as foundational to our survival, to our inclusion. One of my favorite quotes capturing this need to stand proud is by Marianne Williams. She says, "Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our own darkness, that frightens us most. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you." So I think implicit in this is this need to lift up our own strengths, even when there are some cultural norms, not all by any means, that tell us to stand down. A critical factor, if we're raising children or if we're continuing to raise ourselves and we're looking at our own spiritual growth, is to have a positive self-image. Our Unitarian Universalist values ask us to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of all. And I hope everybody here hears that as saying, all include yourself. Not that we're better than the other, but we are fully worthy, fully brought to the table of humanity, however you think about that. We take pride in who we are, and at times, particularly for groups where certain parts of your identity have been squeezed out by cultural norms, you have to elbow in a little bit. Sometimes it doesn't feel like there's room for everyone in the room, and we're asked to make that room. One of my colleagues considers that the core of her theology, that Unitarian Universalists are called to always be making room. It's an active sense of faith. And I think that claiming of pride and identity, particularly for certain groups that have been historically marginalized, is critical to that skill we're called to. And so I didn't just bump into the word pride and decide to preach a sermon on it this week. Part of my scan of your local landscape, of our local landscape, is that on from May 3rd to May 5th will be Maryland's Midshore Celebration of Pride. How many folks have heard that this is coming forward? Okay, those about half, for those who aren't looking out there. It is a chance over a course of a weekend. There will be events in Chestertown, in Easton, in Cambridge, celebrating those with an LGBTQ identity, and there's even more letters one can put after that. So I want to talk a little bit about how gay pride came about. Because as we celebrate identities, as there have been really good conversations at the town council, there have been opportunities to learn. There have been places where people said, oh, everybody will be fine with this, and it turned out they weren't, and then folks have followed up saying, how could I learn more? So part of the Pride Festival weekend, I'm going to go through a little history of Pride here. One of the things we've now added to the agenda for the Pride Festival is a chance to learn. And on April 27th, the week beforehand, using the Easton Unitarian Universalist building as a venue, we're putting together sort of an LGBTQ 101 session for those wanting to learn. Because this Pride Festival is a first on the Eastern Shore. It's been nurtured by this community, by this faith congregation, from your opening of the doors to PFLAG, the work that Linda Dutton has done, the training we've done with our teens through our whole lives. We are not the organizers of this group, but you've nurtured it. You've offered the soil and the water and the different ways we make space for all identities. Pride parades and celebrations have been around for about 50 years now. It was 50 years ago at a gay club in New York City called the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village where the bar was raided. And employees and patrons were hauled out of the bar, and the response, there were 6 days of protest and clashes. There had been gay rights groups before, supporting the rights of homosexuals for decades, but this was a moment of truth in the history of the community. It was 1969, and it was a moment that is claimed as a shift. And I share this story because I don't think of this as LGBTQ history. I think of this as American history. If we are making room and considering breath, all these various stories of history come together. So at about the one-year turning point after Stonewall, folks said we can't let that moment go unrecognized. And there was a little controversy, as there is within all communities. Do we have the nerve to share and celebrate at this point? Some groups thought it was too risky, and Brenda Howard is known as the mother of Pride. She went ahead and pressed for it. There were pride marches, and the estimates are as high as 10,000 people came to that first march in New York City. But that's not to say that was something accepted by any means. The Unitarian Universalist history on LGBTQ issues, I was showing Vita the studies that I looked back on today. In 1967, 80% of Unitarian Universalists that were surveyed wanted homosexuality to be discouraged by education and not law. I take that as an amazement of how societies change. The other night we had a discussion of the book White Fragility, and it's always interesting to look in just 50 years how different things and attitudes change. Because from there, the change in our denomination was rapid. There is an outline of all the different dates that happened over that period as it moved from affirming that we need to be thinking of the welcome for gays and lesbians. The first minister who was called to a pulpit who identified as gay was in 1979 in Maine. In 1990, congregations, now you have to realize, 1990, we're already talking 20 years past these points, the welcoming congregation materials came out, and you'll see when you walk in our congregation's door that this is a welcoming congregation, a place where identities are affirmed. You don't stumble unwelcome. It's intentional. And the materials came out in 1990, and today most congregations display and have done the work that makes the doors open. And the world then had to be expanded to look at trans issues, to look at bisexual issues. And it doesn't get fixed just by laws or by education. It gets fixed as our hearts stretch. one of the histories on the UU website notes that in the 1980s, Pride celebrations expanded way beyond the march format and started to become weekend-long festivals. You hear it called Gay Pride or LGBT Pride or Pride. And the goal is to affirm and celebrate and be proud of sexual diversity and gender variance. As more and more Pride celebrations spilled out through the world, they grew. Last year in Brazil, there were 5 million people at the Pride celebration. In Columbus, Ohio, there were 1 million people at their Pride weekend in 2017. And as they tell the story in Columbus, in 1981, there were 200 people there, but some of them wore bags over their heads, afraid that they could not share that part of who they were. So as we gather on the Midshore, on May 3rd to 5th, there's a chance to come out and learn. It is not a parade, it is a festival. In Chestertown, there's going to be a presence at the Broad Multicultural Festival in Easton, in many ways that we come forward and look at the pattern of how inclusion grows. But I also don't want to pause and think that the work is done. The work of inclusion is in part about laws and in part about celebrations, but it's also about when it happens, that who is leading, what that looks like in the world. We're encouraged to always go deeper. Our learning on these issues is not limited to LGBTQ issues. For all of us to have a strong identity, there is validation needed. For those of us who are doing some of the reading on racial justice these past weeks, we're working through the book White Fragility. And we've looked at the layers of systemic issues. We sat in the sanctuary this past Wednesday night and really tried to dig into what do we thought the systemic issues on matters of race looked like. Where were the cultural norms? Unconscious and conscious behaviors. What was holding systems in place? And so I ask us, as we think of pride, and we think of the work of really claiming identities, expand that. Where else do we stretch? Several that are here today, I know, went to hear Michael Eric Dyson at Chesapeake College last year, who's a noted scholar and preacher on racial justice. And he has actually written on the 7 deadly sins and on pride. And on an NPR talk back in 2006, he says this: in an American society where race has been a marker of degradation or seen, especially blackness, as a floating significator for all that was not excellence, racial pride is very hard. It's a fought for virtue. And sometimes, of course, to be sure, it can become a vice, but a virtue that is a manifestation of the determination to identify with things that are healthy and uplifting. He says, so I don't think it's a given. The myth of the given there has to be dismissed, and I think there's something that people have to work hard for to achieve. And this is when he was talking about pride. So as I close, I ask us to hold both sets of the meaning of pride as we walk. The pride that's celebration and reinforcing of identity, and pride that is a risk, the place to remind us of humility, the place to take us to our better selves, and to make space for all to take full pride in who they are. So I'm grateful for our language, the shift of meanings, and the way pride signifies the need to be noticed, the risk of claiming space in this world, the courage it takes to stand up for one another, and the solidarity it takes to be humans together. with our full range of identities, all of who we are together in humanity. May it be so. Blessed be.